Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Lost in Science for another week. My name is Claire and I am here this week with the one, the only, Chris. Hello.
Hello, Claire. Talking about the one, the only.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, you're the one, the only Claire as well.
Well, Chris, I feel like it's been a hot minute since we've had a show together. And I'm very excited to bring 30 minutes of science to our listeners, 30 minutes of the CC show.
Yeah. Is this your last show for a while?
Well, you know, I might pop up here and there. I don't know. Okay. I'm not going to give you that answer.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay.
Because I don't actually know.
What we're saying, dear listeners, that Claire may be going on hiatus, but that is, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. I have a due date that will not shift, don't I, Chris?
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Creating another person to add to my...
Exactly.
To add to my family of...
Because you don't have enough to do, yeah.
Yeah, because I don't have enough to do. But, you know, it's all in the name of science. It isn't. But anyway, Chris, enough about me. What do you have for us this week?
Well, I tried to find something topical to talk about, and I was inspired by something topical. I didn't try to find it. It happened. So recently you might have seen in the news, there was a woman in South Australia, specifically in Glenelg North Beach in Adelaide. A woman got caught in quicksand.
I didn't hear that. If I was 8 years old, my quicksand radar would have been, you know, razor sharp, and I would have heard about any quicksand incident, but I did not hear about this.
No, look, you're right. Like, quicksand incidents, despite their prevalence in movies and TV shows, particularly of decades past, yeah, they are very precious and rare, but always exciting when it happens.
Always
and
exciting.
We get the chance to talk about quicksand.
Is she so okay? Is she okay?
Yeah. Okay, after a couple of hours, they got her out. But yeah, I thought good time to talk about quicksand.
Oh, what is it? It's always a good time to talk about quicksand.
How does it work?
Oh my goodness. The 8-year-old in me is very excited to hear about this, Chris.
Great. I'm glad. And I hope that the minus a week old in you is also excited to hear.
Also.
About.
Exactly.
Yes. So what have you got for us then?
Claire? Well, I've got something less exciting than quicksand, but still very important. Okay, so when you go to the tropics, Chris, as you know, it's the middle of winter now. We're getting there. Everyone's probably starting to think about a holiday to the tropics, maybe, unless you already live in the tropics. You might want to protect yourself with some mosquito repellent. Right?
Oh, yes.
Well, there's some new research that's come out about a particular kind of mosquito repellent, which is probably one that we're all familiar with, DEET, and showing that it is like the mechanism that DEET uses to repel mosquitoes can actually, there's less known about it than we thought. And scientists have actually trained mosquitoes to be attracted to DEET.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That sounds like a bad idea.
It does sound like a terrible idea, doesn't it? I'm like, you better not have let those mosquitoes out, guys.
So what you're saying is we've got like mosquitoes, we've got quicksand, we've got a jungle adventure going on.
We do have a jungle adventure. I feel like this is somebody sign up Harrison Ford or Michael Douglas or one of those other, you know, 80s adventure heroes because we are we're getting ready to go on a weird jungle adventure in this episode of Lost in Science. On with the show.
All right, yes, you're listening to Lost in Science, and I am getting stuck into quicksand.
No!
Hey. As I said in the intro, in the news recently, due to someone getting caught in quicksand in Adelaide's Glenelg North Beach, but prior to that, mostly known from old TV and movies. Apparently, I saw a thing with Slate magazine, did a bit of analysis. In the 1960s, apparently 3% of films featured some sort of quicksand.
3%. So, yeah. I mean, It's not that high, but it's also not nothing. That's right. Probably quite a lot of films when you work it out.
So, question is, what do we know about quicksand?
Well,
what do you know about quicksand?
Okay, I know you always fall into it in the middle of the movie at the most inopportune time, and it's always a chance for, you know, the hero to prove their worth, you know. Mm. How do they get out of it? It's normally a vine that they can pull themselves out. What do I actually know about it though? I mean, not very much. It doesn't behave like normal sand. Like the more you move, the more you get pulled under.
Something like that. Let's just dive in. I mean, so to speak. And let's stop thrashing about it and see what we can do. Because we will talk about it. I mean, quicksand itself, actually, as far as I could find, not as much study as you'd expect. All the sort of references I found seem to quote one particular paper, which was an article in Nature in 2005. Sorry, I say an article in Nature. It was a one-page brief communication in Nature in 2005. So that's basically the extent that people reference in terms of actual science with quicksand. In this, a physicist, Daniel Bon, and colleagues, they had been to Iran and they encountered some quicksand. So they took it back to the laboratory and they did experiments on it.
Wow.
So,
they didn't get caught in it?
No, they didn't get caught in it. They scooped up some samples. Now, look, it's a tricky thing to talk about this kind of stuff because it's a type of fluid, and fluid mechanics is filled with lots of impenetrable jargon. So we're going to use some of that jargon. My apologies in advance for that. So what it is a quicksand is a colloidal gel.
Okay.
So,
all right. Explain.
It's kind of solid and liquid mixed together, essentially.
Right.
So you've got sand grains suspended in water.
Okay.
So that's what makes it a colloidal gel, and that makes it kind of a fluid, but it's a non-Newtonian fluid.
Ooh.
You know something about non-Newtonian fluids, don't you?
I mean, I know a little bit, mostly to do with the colloidal fluid of slime, cornflower slime.
Yeah. So what's the properties of that, do you know?
So when you apply a force to it, if it's a strong force, then it resists it. But if it's a weaker, slower force, like if you punch it, then it goes solid. But if you slowly go into it, you get stuck and you get really gooey and slimy.
Yeah. So that's, what the kind of slime, also oobleck is another name for that particular cornflour mixture. Yep. So that is a non-Newtonian fluid. And that one non-Newtonian fluid is often what you find is their viscosity changes depending on the conditions. And in that case, when you apply kind of a stress to it, then the viscosity increases. It becomes almost solid.
Yep.
You know, people do things where they fill a swimming pool with custard and can walk on this kind of stuff.
Yep.
But it can go the other way as well. So basically quicksand is sort of the opposite. And there are many non-Newtonian fluids that are kind of the opposite of that, where the viscosity decreases when you apply a stress to it. Something that you've moved that is similar, that you can find in the kitchen, for instance, is tomato sauce.
Oh, that could be a quicksand.
When I was quite thick, normally.
Yeah.
But when you shake it, it becomes liquid. This is why when you shake the bottle of tomato sauce, it suddenly goes blurp out everywhere.
Oh.
It's not just because bad luck. It's because you're actually, by shaking it, you're changing its viscosity and suddenly it turns liquid.
Oh, really? It isn't just that the liquid's been resting somewhere, it actually changes the viscosity.
Well, when it rests, it turns harder.
Oh, wow.
So another good example, probably easy to picture maybe, is yogurt. So yogurt in a pot can be nearly solid.
Yep.
But if you stir it, it's liquid. It's very runny.
Yeah, wow,
So, yeah, it changes depending on what you're doing to it. Kind of a less fun example is the soil liquefaction that you might remember from things like the 2011 Christchurch earthquake, where you had basically it was an earthquake, it shook the ground, and soil kind of turned into liquid and cars and houses sunk into it. So there's also a similar kind of soil with lots of water, so a soil and water mixture. And yeah, when it's shaken, it becomes more liquid. So quicksand is similar to that kind of thing. So it looks solid, but when you step on it, you're creating a pressure, you're creating stress on it, and its viscosity decreases dramatically, which is why you sink into it.
Right. Okay.
And that's why they say don't thrash around, because yes, you'll make it liquid when you thrash around.
That makes sense. So if you need to get out of it, how do you use the viscosity?
Okay. So there is two things here. There's some good news, which is that you can't drown in quicksand.
Okay. That is good news. But the also, movies have been lying to me, Chris.
Well, so the reason you can't drown it might be a non-Newtonian fluid, but it's still a fluid. And so you've got the laws of buoyancy, Archimedes' principle, this kind of thing like that. So you'll sink until the weight of the sand and water that you're displacing matches your weight.
Okay.
That's Archimedes' principle. And the density of quicksand is about twice that of humans. So you can only sink about halfway down.
Right. Okay.
So don't worry about drowning in it. But there is bad news.
Go on.
The bad news is that it's not so straightforward with quicksand. So when it's agitated, as I said, its viscosity decreases. But after that agitation is removed, its viscosity increases to much more than it was when it started. So this is what they say is that the colloidal gel collapses. Essentially, the sand and water separate.
Oh.
Okay? So you basically, what was a nice kind of gel-like thing with sand and water suddenly becomes a sediment of sand.
Oh.
Which a lot harder to get out of.
Oh, gosh.
So you can't just pull on the vine because your foot is literally kind of encased in concrete.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, like,
wow, it actually changes its structure.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh. So in researching this, I came across a story from someone who got stuck in quicksand while hiking through a canyon in Utah. So this person, he sank in up to his thighs, couldn't get out, was stuck there for hours, risked hypothermia because, you know, kind of was in the middle of a canyon in the middle of the night. A helicopter tried to pull him out. First of all, they sent a helicopter after him. They tried to pull him out, but basically when his back started to make popping noises, they gave up. They said, we're going to rip this guy in half.
Oh, my gosh. Tell me there's a good ending to this story, Chris.
No, they basically had to send rescuers in on rafts, essentially, like to sit on rafts so they wouldn't sink in themselves, to dig him out. Because that's basically all they could do is dig him out.
Wow.
And I haven't found out about the woman in Adelaide. She had assistance to get out. She was there for a few hours. I suspect, didn't say the news articles how she got out. I suspect they would have had to dig her out as well. But I don't think she was sunk as far as that. But it was the kind of thing where she got stuck in the quicksand, like, I can't get out. I just cannot get out.
How do we tell if what we're stepping on is going to turn into quicksand? Are there warning signs? I feel like there needs to be a some sort of community notice.
Well, the original one in Iran, I believe there was a literal warning sign.
Okay.
That said, careful, quicksand. But yeah, so it happens when there is this kind of very wet sand. It's not very common. I mean, it doesn't happen a lot. It's newsworthy when it does happen, so it's not terribly common. I mean, the case in Adelaide, it was at the beach. You'd imagine there'd be a lot of kind of sandy conditions like that, but it has to be just the right conditions where it's very kind of liquidy sand that you can get stuck in it like that. So it's not terribly common. I don't actually know what the sign is. The case in Utah, he kind of thought it was solid. It looked solid, the sand. Started to sink as soon as he stepped on it, but kind of did not realize the danger until it was too late, I suppose. So, yeah, I don't really have a good thing for that. The only thing I can think of, though, is some advice. I haven't tried this myself. But I looked at the paper from 2005 where they did the experiments of quicksand. And as I said, the viscosity increases a lot after you remove the agitation, the shaking, the force, whatever like that. But it's a time curve that it increases. So in that, in my mind, there should be a short window after you sink in that is still liquid enough for you to pull out if you know what you're doing. So if there is a handy vine nearby, or you know what you're doing, instead of kind of trying to walk through it and sinking down further, I suppose, which is probably a lot of us would do, if you go, oh no, quicksand, and you're quick enough, right, and you can grab a vine and pull yourself out, then you might be able to do it before it fully sets. But it's a fairly short period of time. But in the paper, it was kind of, it looked like it was up to about five to 10 minutes maybe before it got fully solid.
It's not that long.
I don't know. Again, I'm not advising this. I'm not saying this is going to work because I haven't done the experiment and this was not covered in any of the literature that I could find. But anyway, that's just my idea. But so the moral of the story is that, yes, you can't drown in quicksand, but if it turns into slow sand, then you're stuck.
In the history of science, novel and innovative concepts occasionally arise from sudden left-field inspiration.
Nothing shocks me. Scientist.
But I'd rather be remembered for my own small contributions to science.
I think they're scientists.
I bring scientists, you bring a rock star.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Lost in Science.
Now, Chris, when you head to the tropics, how are you going to protect yourself from mosquitoes? Would you use a mosquito repellent?
I sometimes do. I often, what I find it helps is to stand next to someone who is more attractive to the mosquitoes.
Okay, that's a strategy. That's definitely a one.
Long sleeves, I suppose, can help. But
long sleeves, like normally light coloured materials. But I normally pack some pretty hectic Bushmans or DEET. When I go to the tropics, because I really don't want to risk getting bitten by mosquitoes. So repellents, you know, they're very well known for having, for, you know, doing what we think that they do, which is repel mosquitoes. Mm. You know, I think we think that mosquitoes smell the repellents and stay away. And like I said, DEET is held up as the gold standard for doing this, for keeping mosquitoes away from biting us. But, Chris, there has been some new research that suggests that mosquitoes can actually learn to associate DEET with food and can increase biting even in the presence of DEET. So this raises a lot of questions about the nature of mosquito repellents and the pathways of repellents in general.
It also raises questions about, like, how intelligent mosquitoes are. The fact that you can train them to do something that they normally have to provide DEET repellent, but you can train them to do the opposite of what their instinct would say. That kind of implies that there's a lot more going on.
Oh, there is a lot more going on with mosquitoes than I understood after reading this new research. We can get into that. Absolutely. But what I wanted to start with was, you know, why repellents and DEET matters. And, you know, mosquitoes, when you're dealing with mosquitoes, whether you're training them or not, that you are dealing with the world's most dangerous animal, right? We've all heard that before. They're responsible for 1 million deaths worldwide per year and up to 700 million affected people who can catch mosquito-borne diseases from them. So diseases obviously like malaria, dengue, chikungunya, Japanese encephalitis, Ross River virus. It's millions, like a staggering amount of people. Uh-huh. Heaps more than hippopotamuses in Africa is what I'm saying. Now, DEET, which is the chemical name for DEET, is N-N-diethyl metatoluamide. It was developed by the US military in the 1940s, and it's been widespread and being used since the 1950s.
Do we have to keep calling it DEET, or can we use the full name?
I think we should keep calling it DEET, because the full name is ridiculous. Okay, great. So, yeah, it's considered the gold standard because it's effective, it's long-lasting, it's inexpensive, it's had a lot of study done on it to prove its safety. But despite 80 years of use, scientists don't fully understand exactly how it functions with the mosquito. They understand a lot about its safety with humans, but not really exactly how it works as a repellent.
Okay.
So traditionally, it was thought that mosquitoes smell DEET and are repelled by it. They just don't like the smell. And then in 2008, researchers showed that DEET actually can block sensoring neurons in the mosquitoes. So there's some sort of physiological sensory block to detect host odors. So instead of like repelling the mosquitoes, it's actually confusing them. It
stops them smelling the human?
Yeah, it stops them smelling the human. And sort of like disrupting their ability to find us rather than actually presenting a keep away signal. And then other studies further on from 2008 have shown that some mosquitoes can be genetically insensitive to DEET, so that they can temporarily become less sensitive after a repeated exposure to the chemical. So taken all these sort of things taken together, they suggest that, you know, the repellent nature of DEET or nature of mosquitoes repellent isn't the whole story. There's this maybe physiological sensory blocking and maybe some behavioral effects involved as well. So anyway, there's been new research that has just been published recently in the Journal of Experimental Biology. And they published this paper. It's called Associative Learning Switches DEET Valence from Aversive to Appetitive in Aedes aegypti. Aedes aegypti being a type of mosquito. It's the one responsible for dengue fever and a bunch of other diseases as well. And the researchers asked whether mosquitoes' response to DEET, is it fixed within the mosquito, within the physiology of the mosquito, or whether they can learn to see DEET as something positive, whether they can be trained to like it. Thus, this going from aversive to appetitive. Oh. Anyway, can it be attractive if it's associated with a reward? And so the first thing they did was build a mosquito learning test, this new behavioral measure. They called it the biting attempt response. And they pretty much, like we said earlier, they turned mosquitoes into Pavlov's dogs. And this biting attempt response measures whether mosquitoes are expecting food. So they came up with this behavioral measure and then allowed them to test whether they could train mosquitoes into learning an association, a positive association with the DEET repellent. So they took female mosquitoes. As you know, female mosquitoes are the only ones that have a blood feed. They need a blood feed to be able to reproduce and lay eggs. So they took the female mosquitoes and they exposed them to DEET while feeding on blood, just a little spray of DEET in the air. And then later, when they were exposed to DEET on its own, these mosquitoes showed more biting behavior. So they actually trained them to, when they were exposed to DEET, a little bit of DEET in the air when they were biting, they then showed more biting behavior. Mosquitoes that were exposed to DEET before they bit did not show this effect. So it's all about timing here. And the association only formed when DEET was linked directly with the reward. So in the wild, if you've got DEET on and the mosquito smells the DEET, then they're not going to go for the bite. But if they're biting you and then you spray a little bit of DEET in the space, they can develop an association between DEET and having a yummy feed.
Okay. So what are you saying?
Well,
if you're being bitten, it's already too late.
If you're being bitten and they squirt the DEET in the air, then they can learn to associate the reward of the blood with the DEET in the air. So just make sure you put your DEET on before you go out, rather than when you're being
bitten.
Don't
put it on afterwards. It doesn't fix
exactly.
It,
it, doesn't, it doesn't fix help.
It makes it worse, in fact.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So then they actually tested on real human skin. So one of the researchers put their hand on the line for science and offered a real-life arm as a reward. The mosquitoes got a choice between a DEET-treated hand and an untreated hand. So the untrained mosquitoes, the non-Pavlovian dog mosquitoes, avoided the DEET-treated hand, but about 50% of the mosquitoes that were trained went to the DEET hand. So this is pretty high and was significant enough to show that yes, they had changed their behaviour in this realistic setting. So first, when this sort of just shows, like, it's not just, it doesn't just happen when there's a blood bag in a lab in a lab, but it also happens when there's a hand in the lab. So yeah, the study shows that mosquitoes don't respond to DEET really in a fixed way and can experience a change of DEET as from negative to positive. And so hopefully, even though DEET works extremely well and is one of our best defences, it does suggest that we probably need to do a little bit more research about it, about what is actually going on. Is repellent actually a repellent, or do we need to make some better repellents for the future?
Yeah, got to say, that sucks pretty much.
And that's all we have time for on this episode of Lost in Science. Lost in Science is recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nations and the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at lostinsight@gmail.com, or just listen again next week when Lyndon, Claire, Chris and Stu get lost in science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.